strong, and I wish you well in the weeks to come.
Thank you, Gareth. Good night to you.
Take care. Thanks, Brendan. That's Brendan Ogle there. And as I say, over the next, what is it, 5 weeks? 5 weeks from, is it 5 weeks from tomorrow? Yeah, 5 weeks from tomorrow, we'll have the local and European elections on the 7th of June. So we'll talk more about that. As I say, there'll be more issues in relation to candidates, and there'll be more candidates talking about issues, and more listeners talking about candidates and issues over the next 5 weeks. We'll take a break. If you have an interest in drug addiction and drug rehabilitation, and you see one as being incomplete without the other, well, I think you're going to be interested in what we have for you just after the news at 11.
Nighttime Talk. Call us now on 0818 942 105.
Ireland's Classic Hits Radio.
Hi, Jennifer here from Two's Company, Ireland's leading dating agency. Are you fed up wasting time online, searching through countless profiles? Try a more personal and professional approach. Two's Company guarantee introductions to people who really want a relationship, people with a very high level of compatibility. So sit back and let us do the searching for you. See twoscompany.ie today. And remember, you're in good company with Two's Company.
If you're feeling the chill, get your home winter ready now. Wrapped up nice and cozy with external insulation from First Choice PHC. Reduce your energy bills by up to 50% while increasing the value, warmth and comfort of your home. We're also your first choice for heat pumps, gas and oil. So, make First Choice your only choice for external wall insulation. Significant SEAI grants available. See firstchoicephc.com.
You're listening to Nighttime Talk
with recruit.ie, Ireland's new online job search. Search for your dream job today on recruit.ie.
Ireland's Classic Hits Radio. Nighttime Talk.
Call us now on 0818 942 105.
Ireland's Classic Hits Radio.
Hi, I'm Megan Scully, and this is Crack August Kjol on Ireland's Classic Hits Radio. Emile Amigad Nocha Do, 4 months and two's album of Billy Ray Cyrus. August Vian Tauron, Achy Breaky Heart, Le Fall Air. Dan Sheg bore on Billboard, Rochade, Erfa, Shach Zeg Shachtana. Freshen, Emile Amigad Nocha Do, Rogan Tauroni, Sam Smith in London. Emile Amigad Octo Hoch, 4 months album, Ever It's Eh, Owen Tauroni, Prince. I'm going down. Gáil is a sé, Vui Lordi on Eurovision. Isas on Inlan Atoshi. That's Crack August Kjol on Ireland's Classic Hits Radio.
Across Cork, Limerick, Clare and Galway.
On your phone.
And on your smart speaker.
This is the home of the 80s and 90s.
This is Ireland's Classic Hits Radio.
It's 11 o'clock. I'm Breffni Clark. Good evening. Benjamin Netanyahu has vowed Israel will stand alone in its war against Hamas in Gaza and fight with its fingernails if it has to. An unnamed Israeli official says its military will press ahead with an operation in Rafah. Matthew Miller from the US State Department says Washington continues to urge caution.
They have talked, I think, quite openly about conducting a major military operation in Rafah. We are opposed to that, but we'll see what happens. We have made quite clear we don't want to see it happen. We continue, and I should say, we do continue to engage with them about other options that they can pursue.
A man has died in a scrambler bike crash in Dublin. It happened in Blanchardstown at around 10 past two this afternoon. The driver of the scrambler bike, a man in his 20s, was pronounced dead at the scene. Gardaí are appealing for witnesses to come forward. People are more worried about the environmental impact of food packaging rather than emissions from red meat. New research from the ESRI found people mistakenly think beef or lamb produced in Ireland has a lower environmental impact compared to fruit that's been imported. Israel has gone through to Saturday's Eurovision Song Contest, having qualified following a public vote in the semi-finals in Sweden. Despite being booed during rehearsals, 20-year-old Eden Gullen performed cheers on the night. Organisers had said they wouldn't censor the audience. Protesters outside the Malmo Arena said the exclusion of Israel was essential.
It's the most outrageous thing that I've ever heard of. Absolutely insane. They have absolutely nothing to do there. And don't tell me it's not political, because it has been political every single year until now. Yeah, you can't. I mean, the songs have been political, the statements have been, everything has been political.
And that's your news for now.
Ireland's weather.
With McCarthy Insurance Group. For better value home, farm, motor, life, health and business insurance in 2024. MIG.ie.
Continuing dry nationwide tonight with various cloud amounts. Clear spells will increase overnight and isolated mist and fog patches will form. Temperatures coming down to between 7 and 11 degrees. You're up to date at the home of What Did Lucy Kennedy Say to Colm Hayes? Ireland's Classic Hits Radio.
Now, Nighttime Talk on the home of the 80s and 90s.
Ireland's Classic Hits Radio.
Into our third hour of Nighttime Talk tonight. Thanks for all of your lovely comments, by the way, in relation to the conversations tonight and to some rather stiff comments as well in relation to the conversations tonight. That's the great thing about this show. One of the many things I love about it. And nice to hear so many of you who have had business and meetings with Brendan Ogle down through the years, wishing him all the best in his campaign. Now, it's, 7 minutes past 11. It's Gareth O'Callaghan. We're with you through till 12 midnight. I've got a very special guest I'll be introducing you to very shortly. Her work is in addiction treatment, but also in the whole study of addiction treatment and addiction recovery, and as it were, merging the two of them, because without one, the other is lost. So, in other words, if you go for addiction treatment and you leave the addiction centre, for example, if you do find a centre that will take you in and treat you, but following the treatment, if there's no addiction recovery programme, well, then it's very understandable why an individual relapses so quickly. And many years ago, and it is many years ago at this stage, probably 20 years ago, we had very defined attitudes towards addiction. There was drug addiction, there was gambling addiction, there was alcohol addiction. Back then, the whole eating disorders thing wasn't regarded as an addiction. It was regarded as an illness. It was regarded as a disorder. Exercising, dieting, shopping, sex addictions, pornography addictions, video gaming, generally using the internet, and let's face it, I mean, those of you who remember Netscape Navigator, which would have been 1994, and Brendan Ogle referred to it before the news there, where you had to dial up on the old landline at home in order to connect with the World Wide Web. Now the internet is, it's unrecognisable compared to the internet we had back in the 1990s. So we're looking at a combination of familiar addictive activities with non-substance addictions. And it's a huge area. It's a huge spectrum. And we're going to be talking about that over the next 45 minutes or so, right up until the end of the show tonight. And I'd love to hear from you if you're involved in addictive treatment, if you're involved in rehabilitation, if you've been through the system. And it's a very strange system. It's very difficult to understand and to explain if you haven't been in it as either an addict or someone who befriends addicts in whatever way in the different systemized forms of it. And there are so many of them now. I'd like to hear from you. Please give us a call. You can WhatsApp us on 087-188-0008. Susan is on the line. Hi there, Sarah. Sorry. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, how's it going?
It's going well, thank you. And thanks for calling us up tonight and thanks for having a chat with us. How do you feel about drug addiction?
How do I feel about it?
Yeah.
I'm just going to give you a brief introduction, right?
Okay.
I was an active addict and alcoholic.
Right.
For many years. Okay. And through parts of my addiction, I really loved it. And then later part, I really hated it. And the bottom line was I tried to go in and out and try and get clean and sober. However, between policies in the country, I couldn't. I either had to deal with one addiction or the other. But I refused. So I wanted to do both, but I eventually got there.
Well done.
And that was a little over 24, 25 years ago.
Wow. And you, so haven't, like, you haven't slipped at all in that time, no?
No,
wow.
No.
Congratulations.
No, I haven't.
That's brilliant.
And but, like, as I say, there's so many different ways, pathways now to recovery. There's loads of different supports out there today, an awful lot more effective than there would have been back 20-odd years ago. You know, and recovery is possible, and I will promote that in every area, in every area of addiction.
Are more people, are more people sympathetic to addiction?
In regards to stigma, it'll always be there. I'll always say that, the stigma will be. I'm not saying people be two-faced to your face, but some people, well, I basically won't walk around eggshells. I am who I am. The way I look at it today is what you put into life, you get back out of it. And that's in every area of life, you know, whether you're in addiction or not. But, yeah, no, I've zero tolerance as well in regards to them trying to legalise it. I think, as the saying goes, you know, one is too many and a thousand is never enough, you know, and that's the way it goes. And
when you say you were you were addicted to drugs and to alcohol, did one addiction feed the other?
Well, at the start, like, it really depended. Like, I really started off basically with alcohol and benzos, and I tried every different tablet, every different way, and then I just went further on into injection and snorting and just drinking, and just basically I can't remember the 90s, you know, like the late 80s and the 90s. It was really in the very late 1997, 98, where I got clean sober. I was going into the Northies then, like, or in 2000.
Where did you get sober, can I ask?
Well, I went into Kildare, I got a detox centre, and then from there I went on into the Rutland Centre.
Yeah.
And then from there I went into Solitude, that was a rehabilitation. I had no education under my belt, I did a few courses. That was to build up interpersonal skills, communication skills. I had to learn how to deal with my feelings. So there was an aftercare program. We dealt with Solitude and with the aftercare program from the Rutland Centre as well. So that's basically helping you to integrate back into society, because you're sort of feeling again. And then you're talking to family members that you may have never spoken to.
Yeah.
You have broken relationships to build up, and it's very unhealthy to try and deal with all of these things when you're only fresh now in recovery.
Yeah. And what was Sarah, what was the attraction of the drugs? What was it to kill the feelings that you eventually had to come to acknowledge and to come to learn how to deal with?
No, like, to be quite honest, I from day one, I never liked the taste of alcohol. I never liked the way it made me feel.
Yeah.
In regards to when I was injection, like, I was just like, I felt normal. You know, I felt I could talk. It gave me a voice.
Can you describe that word normal? Because it's something that I've never really understood. When people say he's normal or he's not normal, what was normal to you?
Well, normal is an individual thing. That's the way I basically say. But like, which way could I describe it? Like, just to talk to somebody, like, just to communicate, just to feel comfortable in my body. That's the only way I can explain it. You know, because I either had that feeling that I felt unloved or unwanted, or, you know, like, I wish I came from a different family, or I wish my life was this way, I wish my life was that way. I'm blaming everybody around me except looking at myself. You know, and I'm not going to say I'm the education either, because, like, I had a good upbringing. I loved going to school. I wouldn't have been the brightest in school. And I think a lot came from that as well, with low self-esteem and not being able to put your hand up in class and saying, I don't understand that. You know, by keeping your head down. And, you know, little things like that.
Yeah.
And then leaving school early and getting into the wrong company. And then you get the attention, and then you're seeking the attention, and you're getting the attention, and it's all negative. There was nothing positive there.
And, like, you're clean and you're sober and you're drug free for a long, long number of years. Like, all those years back, when you're completely tied into that way of life, that way of thinking, that way of looking for your next fix. Were the drugs easy to get?
Well, the obsession was there, of course, yeah.
Yeah.
They were. Like, it's a lot different now, Garrett, out there. Like there are totally different drugs out there that weren't backed out there back years ago. It's just totally chaos out there at the moment.
Mm.
There's a lot of drugs being mixed. Children don't know what that, even people out there, they don't know what they're taking. Mm. You know, and I've been educated about it. I did addiction studies. I went on to do other different courses. The consequences, like, education, like, I would have loved to be educated back then, but even at that, I don't think I would have got clarity, yeah, or epiphany, as I usually say. But I don't think I would have got clarity on where drugs or addiction can bring you, being active in addiction. You know, and that's the sad part about it years ago. But there's plenty of awareness out there. There's plenty of help. Mm. And in the treatment centres that I was in there, there were people in there from gambling, sex, eating disorders. And I've also worked in that area as well in regards to people with mental health in addiction. And I've seen other sides of it. Like, and I've seen other people not recovering. Mm. I've been in treatment with people that died. They only got out and they died 2 or 3 days after being in treatment, like, you know, so I've been around the full circle. I've been around the block, you know, but it's a daily thing to me, and it's one day at a time.
Yeah.
I don't think as it one day at a time. I just pray that, like, I don't mean actually down on my knees and pray. I know some people do.
But that you just get through the day.
No, I'm just so grateful that the obsession is gone.
Yeah.
Like, the obsession is not there for that.
Yeah.
You know, it's a totally different quality of life.
Mm.
I had to change my thinking, and that was a very hard thing to do.
Did you have to shed friends?
Well, I wouldn't call them friends because, it's sort of a rat race when you're out there in addiction.
Mm-hmm.
But it's
stay,
great.
Sarah,
to
stay
like,
there. I've got Sarah, Susan on the line. Hi, Susan.
Hi, Garrett. How are you?
Thank
you very much for having me on the show.
Great to talk to
you. I'd just like to say, thank you. I'd just like to say big congratulations to Niall for becoming an MEP. It's fabulous news.
Well, he hasn't become one yet, but we're thinking of him. Yeah.
Well, we'll all give him our number one vote, and hopefully he will.
Okay. Well,
So, Garrett, about the drugs.
Yes.
Yeah. I don't know. That other boy there on the phone,
mm-hmm.
He was talking about...
Is it Sarah?
He was talking
Sarah,
about,
yeah.
Oh, the other girl on the phone, sorry.
Yeah, that's Sarah, yeah.
She was the girl who was in addiction.
Mm.
And I don't know her feelings on it about decriminalised. Does she believe they should be decriminalised?
What do you think,
What's
Sarah?
What's my belief?
100%
no. 100%
no?
No.
No. Don't decriminalise them.
No.
No.
Do you think
they
should be decriminalised?
I think so. For what it's worth, Garrett, now, I wouldn't be as clever as Sarah. I haven't been in addiction places. The only thing I've seen is that place on the quays there. It's some kind of a project.
Yeah.
I used to work in a pizza parlour and I'd bring them down pizzas, you know, and then they'd be looking for cigarettes off you and they'd be shouting at you. And, you know, there's some project it's called. But anyway, for what it's worth, this is my take on it.
Mm.
I've been to Amsterdam and I thought it was a fabulous place and so friendly, so laid back, such beautiful people. I've also been to Norway, and I'm not trying to say, oh, this country is that way or that country is that way. But in Norway, everyone is quite serious, you know. It's not really laid back. It's quite, you know, doggy. Not like, you know.
Yeah.
And then behave yourself and go to work and, you know, maybe because they get so much rain. I don't know. Do they seem to be a bit, you know, robot-like?
Right.
Anyway, I don't want to say they're all like that in Norway.
Sure, they don't get as much rain as we do. But sorry, go ahead, yeah.
They get 240 days of it. So I don't know. They probably get near enough the same.
I think we
but
get
anyway,
300 of it. Go ahead,
this is my feeling on drugs.
Okay.
In Amsterdam, right?
Mm-hmm.
You can get any drugs you want. They're all very friendly. They're all very laid back. They're lovely.
Mm.
So I'm thinking, if you decriminalise it, would it become like that? Would it become a place where everybody is soft, well, gentle, easygoing?
Yes.
I'm not saying they're not easygoing in Norway. Norway is like here.
Amsterdam is not a good comparison. I mean, yeah. Sorry, Sarah.
You know, I remember years ago going to Amsterdam, and I was actually went in for a cup of coffee, and I was sitting down and I lit up a cigarette and I was told to leave. And I went, excuse me?
Oh, fuck.
They actually told me to leave.
Well, I thought they were okay over there.
Yeah.
No, I was lighting up a normal cigarette and she says, no, sorry, you can only smoke. And I said, you're cracking jokes. And I started breaking my hair laughing because I thought it was ironic. Like, you know what I mean? I was about to go over to the Van Gogh Museum and the doctor's there. But I thought it was so funny, like.
Did you get into the Van Gogh Museum? I couldn't get in.
Look, I'm going to have to say goodbye to the two of you, I'm afraid. Sarah, I'm so proud of you. Well done on your achievement and keep it going. And thanks for all of the help you show us, so many other people.
Well, I'm as recovery as possible for everybody.
Great to talk to you. Take care, Sarah. Long. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. And that's Susan there. And we must talk about the Van Gogh Museum again. Now, I'm going to take a short break, but I'm really looking forward to talking to my special guest tonight between now and the end of the show in about 35 minutes or so. If you're interested in addiction treatment and you're also equally interested in addiction recovery, let us know your feelings. Let us know your experience, please. 087-188-0008. Back after this break.
Nighttime Talk. Call us now on 0818 942 105.
Ireland's Classic Hits Radio. Damien Farrelly in the afternoon.
Weekday afternoons from 2. Please join me for the latest trending stories. If you love your nostalgia, it's a bit like reeling in the ears on the radio. We call it Back to the Future. There's over €2,000 to be won if you can tell me what Lucy Kennedy said to Colm Hayes. Plus, only top tunes from the 80s and 90s.
Weekdays from 2 p.m. with Tesco. Feel the power to lower prices with your Tesco Club card.
Ireland's Classic Hits Radio.
All aboard for the Cove Heritage Centre tour.
Take a historic trip back in time and visit our ancestors from the past. For more than 25 years, we've been telling the emigrant story. So come and join the journey. Follow the footsteps of our ancient ancestors and feel history come alive. See our opening times and plan your visit at coveheritage.com. Cove Heritage Centre, a highlight of Ireland's ancient East.
You're listening to Nighttime Talk
with Recruit.ie, Ireland's new online job search. Search for your dream job today on Recruit.ie.
Ireland's Classic Hits Radio.
087-188-0008 is our number on Nighttime Talk tonight. This is Gareth O'Callaghan. Now, according to my special guest this evening, the state's current approach to dealing with drug addiction is broken. Her name is Dr. Joanna Ivers. She's an Associate Professor for Public Health and Primary Care at Trinity College in Dublin. And she joins me on the line right now. Now, I understand you're more a morning person, Joanna.
Probably like me too.
But I'm slowly trying to readjust to the late night show. Thank you for joining us. First of all, we've been chatting to some listeners tonight in relation to drug addiction and their own personal recovery. But it's
brilliant.
I think you said last year, actually, at a conference, people go into treatment with nothing and then leave recovery with nothing. So it's not unusual or, you know, it's understandable why they would relapse. Isn't that the case?
Well, I suppose, yeah, in the broadest sense, what I was talking about is the current state of treatment services. So just to come out of the traps and say that there's some wonderful people doing amazing stuff in the treatment services. But the way in which we offer treatment to people is disproportionate. So there's a bunch of people that show up to treatment. Fewer of those people progress through treatment. Fewer of those attain recovery. So in other words, they've resolved a drug or alcohol or behavioural issue. And very few of those, Gareth, go on to sustain recovery. And what I mean by that is if I took a baseline measure today and came back in 6 months, 12 months, 24 months, would their gain in treatment still be sustained over time?
Mm.
And what we know is that the people who do succeed in treatment, so who go on to treatment, have what we refer to as recovery capital. So in other words, they have a number of factors that support them once they complete their treatment. So that's, you know, having strong relationships, having a good house to go home to, being engaged with their community, having access to employment, having access to education. So collectively, they've got factors in their arsenal that will earn them to go on beyond treatment. What we know about the people who don't succeed is they're more likely to be homeless, they're more likely to have a co-occurring mental health issue, they're more likely to have left school early and either have no education and no access to employment. So in other words, the people who succeed are coming with a collective of recovery capital, and the people who are leaving that unsuccessfully don't have that same level of capital, and then we're wondering why people are failing, and we're stigmatizing people for not retaining the gains of their treatment. And effectively what you're talking about is giving someone access to a bed, keeping them cocooned in a treatment setting, and then often sending them back to an environment where, you know, drugs are very available, the supports that they have are minimal, and the opportunities then to have a better quality of life is minimal as well. So effectively we're setting people up, and the very difficult thing is that we have a number of amazing people at treatment services that are dragging people over the line and doing the impossible, finding a house in the middle of a housing crisis, trying to get people into a HEI when our numbers had never been higher, trying to negotiate a labour market when our skill set has never called for a higher level. But they're still doing the impossible. And then we use things like phrases like, oh, we need to take a health-led response. Yes, we are often talking about health, and recovery is a health issue.
Yeah.
But often the supports that people need are psychosocial. So they go beyond the health system. But we have a health workforce and a health budget that's picking up the tab for other agencies like housing agencies, employment agencies and such. So, yeah, it's a systemic issue. And if we keep going the way we're going, we're just, you know, setting people up for failure and then stigmatizing them for not making it work.
Yeah, I'm thinking, Joanna, of situations, and they're quite common. I've seen them where individuals who do present for treatment and then eventually reach that stage where they're at a level of recovery where they can move back into an environment that they came from. But within that environment, as you say, drugs are available, drugs are being abused. But that can also be the case in relationships between partners and husbands and wives. What sort of path is taken there, where you know if a wife is going to go back, having been treated and, you know, clean, goes back into a relationship with, say, a husband who's still abusing the drugs, there's no hope of recovery there, is there?
Well, I wouldn't like to say there's no hope for recovery there.
Well,
but
no,
again,
I shouldn't say that, and I apologise. Yeah.
No, it's fine. But you're sending someone back to a system that's very clearly inadequate, and you're not addressing the underlying issues. And we know that, you know, women who use drugs are more likely to be in a relationship with a man who uses drugs.
Mm-hmm.
Again, not giving people adequate support before they leave. And again, what we know is people who do well have good relationships. As you say, it seems like it's very trite and obvious, but so they're the kind of things that we need to be building up in people, that level of capital. And not sending people back to systems and situations that are very clearly not working.
Yeah.
And then stigmatizing them for not succeeding.
Now, one of the aspects you were discussing in that conference last year was in relation to Garda discretion and the Garda's reaction to individuals who they may arrest or they may question. And you feel that Gardaí should use more discretion about whether someone should be referred to treatment or be prosecuted?
Yeah, well, what I'm very clearly saying is that when it comes to people having a criminal conviction for something that they may have done two decades ago, is something that will hold people back. So it will have a detrimental effect on people trying to recover. So in other words, if you're somebody that is caught in possession of a drug and you are prosecuted for that, albeit a small level of personal use, going forward into the future, then you've very limited opportunity for specific types of work, like, you know, youth work, certain healthcare jobs, immigration. You know, it curbs people's potential. So I think, again, at a systemic level, we need to look at what that will do in the long term. And, you know, punishing people at that level, is it really... it's not working. Drugs have never been more available. We've never had more types of drugs than we do today. And, you know, in 6 months' time, that will only have increased. So this, you know, approach that we're taking isn't really that effective.
So it's easier now for a young teenager to get street drugs than it is to go into a pub and buy an alcoholic drink. Can you ever see that being any different? Can you ever see that the tide being stemmed, or is it too late?
Again, I mean, I've dedicated my whole... I wouldn't like to say that it's too late, but I think that we need to come at it from a very different perspective, because what we're doing at the moment isn't necessarily working.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't working.
Okay. And... going back to the traditional 12-step program, is that mm-hmm. still very popular? Is it still very effective?
It is. It is. And what's really interesting, Gareth, is that we're starting to see the emerging science around peer-led programs that help people, like you say, like fellowships. And very newer developments, kind of spin-offs from that, are recovery coaches. So people who, again, are modelling recovery, who are showing people in their community that recovery is possible. They're walking that journey with them. And so we know that that peer-led, role model-based therapy is something that, you know, it's a point of relativity. People like to be able to relate to someone and say, you're like me, and therefore, if you did it, I can do it. And if your story is similar to mine, then it gives me hope and it makes me believe that it's possible. And they're the kind of things that we know work for behavioural change and modification. So, but there is a strong emerging science in the US, you know, very staunch science like Cochrane reviews that are showing the evidence around fellowship. It's been one of the best kept secrets because of the anonymity in the recovery community. But again, it is something that works for a particular type of people. So what we need to do is broaden that menu of things out. And we've seen the introduction of, you know, newer type fellowship programs like Smart Recovery, which again appeals to other people because it doesn't have that underlying connection with religion or spirituality.
Power.
That some people may shy away from. And then the recovery coaching is then another version of that again is scientifically very sound and is a very effective model. I would say, you know, it's one thing that we're doing really well and we could do it very effectively. So you could have a recovery coach in emergency departments, in police stations when people get arrested, in emergency departments if people overdose, so that you're because often people feel stigmatized, they leave the health system, they won't get treated, they'll discharge themselves early. And again, the recovery coach is that gap or that bridge between they're not professionals, they're very much peers, and it is a complementary system, I would say, to what we have at the moment. And again, if we look at countries like the US and now the UK, we're seeing that those recovery-oriented systems of care are really effective.
And are they available through fellowship programs? Because I know of some individuals who've been very reluctant to go to the fellowship meetings because they just feel they're walking into a room of people who, as one man said to me, they've done it. They're past the horrors I'm going through and I don't know what to say to them. Do you find in your work that there's still a reluctance for people who are, you know, in the throes of addiction, in the gutter, as they say in some of the fellowship meetings? Is there a reluctance there?
I think there's a reluctance there because we're talking about people and people are different across the board. So we will appeal to some more than others for a variety of reasons. But the coaches is a whole different thing. So, yes, there are sponsors that guide you through the fellowship and they're kind of different. Mm. The coaches are very much just a buddy in recovery. As you say, now they have walked before the person, so in the sense that their recovery is probably a couple of years older. But I suppose fellowship should really be made up of people that are, you know, coming at all stages. But I get it, certain meetings become very established and therefore people feel that there's an established group that they're walking into. So that would always be, I could see how that would be an issue, yeah.
Is there an increase? Do you notice from your own work? Is there emerging from what we're seeing these days? Is there an increase in addictions now among very young people, people we would still regard as children?
Well, there's a stable presentation at adolescent services around cannabis and weed and smokable kind of substances. But what's interesting at an adult level is that we've seen for the first time ever in 2022 that cocaine is the biggest presentation at treatment. So we had a system that was set up to deal with opioids and it's still very much opioid centric. And now what we have is a whole other different type of presentation that's showing up. So for the first time in the history of our treatment services, we've got a very different presentation that is for cocaine that is dominating the adult services and creeping into the adolescent. So alcohol and cannabis type products will be what dominates the presentations for young people.
Mm. And just you mentioned the opioid crisis there, which I suppose looking back at the, you know, the Sackler family and the likes of Purdue Pharma and the OxyContin addiction crisis. Are we seeing a lot of that here now?
Are we seeing a lot? I think traditionally we would have been seeing our problem of, we would have seen our problem around heroin users. So opiates, you know, and opioids collectively referred to then. Synthetic. I think that it is a hidden problem. In fact, we're about to produce a piece of work for the HSE, which is looking at the prescribed opioids across older populations in Ireland. And I think that that's going to show trends that people don't realise is happening in terms of prescription and prescription opioids that you're talking about that fuels the US. Because we have a different, we think we had a different opioid crisis for a long time, but I think that that's in the background, and I think that it is happening, and that we kind of need to look at those trends too.
And Joanna, do you find that you're following in the footsteps of the drug addiction itself? That do you think the system, the health system, will ever be able to get ahead of the addiction in the sense that you can, as it were, foresee what's coming rather than try to catch up with it after it has arrived?
Yeah, I do think that we can, but I think that we need an absolute systemic shift, you know, that big changes, transformational changes need to happen. And so with the current people who are experiencing addiction, we need to bookend recovery supports because otherwise we're just treating people for a period and then expecting that, you know, that will sustain itself. And as I say, for all the reasons I mentioned earlier, that's just not going to happen. Mm. And then the other area, as you say, to get out in front of it is the preventative stuff. And I think, you know, we've been quite naive. We've tended to see prevention as an off-the-shelf program that where we go into schools and tell kids not to take drugs, and that is obviously part of prevention.
Yeah.
Prevention is not that different to recovery, in that you have to. So what we know drives recovery is nature, nurture, and neighbourhood. So where people work, where they live, and where they play, and the social determinants of health is what fuels addiction. And so if we're serious about really shifting it and changing it, and as to borrow your words, to get out in front of it, prevention has to be about creating pathways so that young people don't take drugs, or if they do take drugs, that they have something else that fuels them to go on to do something else. So something I talk about a lot is, you know, if we look at student populations, they're a great example of a population of people who, you know, drugs are part of society and a lot of people will use drugs, but 90% of people will use drugs without perceived consequence. So, and they'll transition in and transition out. And students are a great example because they'll use drugs. They'll use them because they want to be socially connected. People in their group is using them. It takes the edge off at the end of the week. You know, they'll have all of these reasons why they want to use drugs. But when life kicks in and they get an internship, or they go on to get married, or they get a job, or they move away and their social connection is broken, then the drugs will lose their appeal and they go on to, as I say, that capital kicks in and they're getting their needs met somewhere else. And so effectively, that's what we need to do when we're looking at prevention. How do we create capital for young people so that if they are using drugs, and then they decide that they don't want to use it, that their life is, you know, they have options, they have opportunities, and they don't come with a whole set of complex needs when we're trying to, you know, treat the addiction. So again, I would bookend, if I was to spend, you know, allocate money, I would be bookending treatment with a whole load of prevention and a whole load of treatment options on the other side. And yes, it's going to cost money, and people will talk about why should we spend money on people who use drugs. Well, very crudely, recovery is good for everyone, because people who get recovery, they contribute to their community, they contribute to the economic coffers. You know, recovery is good for all of us. It takes away the burden from the health system that, you know, often we experience with addiction. And so, you know, even if you're a person very crudely that doesn't care about addiction, recovery is really good for everyone.
Yeah, and I've heard that question being asked on so many occasions, and it's a rather cruel and sarcastic
question. It's awful. It's an awful question, yeah.
Because, I mean, at the end of the day, the drugs are so freely available and so relatively affordable, depending on you know, if and the problem is that if you start using, there's a possibility you'll start selling and making the drug available so that you can obviously feed your own habit. Can I talk to you about the cannabis situation at the moment? We're hearing a lot of the argument, some people saying it's pretty harmless and that no, it doesn't cause psychosis, as it has been proved it has in some cases. And the reason I just mention it is because just there's a mother here is after texting to say, I think my young son who's 16 is using cannabis. Can you tell me the signs of cannabis use, because he's denying it?
Well, first of all, you know, I would say that no drug is harmless. You know, drugs are, they're not regulated, they're not quality controlled, you're not buying them off this, in this standardized systems. And they often, we've seen, you know, cannabis with lots of adulterants. So I would say that, you know, drugs are never a safe thing. We should keep people safe who use drugs. And we, you know, it's their national policy to for harm reduction. And I would support that. But I don't think that cannabis is, you know, harmless.
Yes.
So just to kind of to say that. And I mean, the signs of cannabis use are similar to lots of other drugs. Like, there will be an effect and the young person will look affected. And obviously, the one thing about cannabis is that it is... it's quite a potent smell. So, you know, generally, if people are smoking cannabis, you would pick that up in terms of a smell as well. But, you know, when people are using drugs, we can expect to see a shift in their behavior, their mood, their eating habits. You know, again, if it's at a problematic level, of course, if someone's just recreationally using, then it would be less obvious the spot, you know.
And I mean, you just mentioned there, like, this is, you know, activating the whole reward center of the brain and producing feelings of pleasure. And the dopamine hit, which so many people are, they're not aware of, but they follow it. And you're upping the ante all the time, aren't you? You've got to take more and more in order
well,
to get that.
Well, that's a tolerance
hit.
Issue, yeah. From a physiological perspective, you will build a tolerance, and so you will always need more. And the dopamine one is not even just as simple as, you know, you're seeking more, but it's a case of what goes up has to come down. So you're kind of borrowing off your own system. So every time you get that surge, and drugs have an exaggerated sense in terms of neurotransmitters like dopamine, that they have this surge effect. So, you know, we get dopamine rush from, you know, seeing someone we like eating a piece of chocolate, but something like cocaine or cannabis will give you a rush of, or an exaggerated surge of dopamine. And the trouble with that then is that you're just borrowing your level. So it will go up, and then the threshold that you, the natural threshold you have, it will keep continually falling below that. And suddenly you're in a deficit. So what you started out seeking pleasure for will just keep you at the norm. And that's why people keep up in the ante, because they're chasing that original kind of rush and high. And it just never happens at that level again until you detox and reset, and then you would obviously potentially go back to that.
And is that where the inclination kicks in to try a stronger type of drug or to move to another drug?
Yeah, and you see, I mean, you see things as well, other risky behaviours, like, I mean, heroin's a good example, or cocaine, where people will shift the mode of taking it. So they might go from smoking or snorting to injecting, because again, as you say, the potency or the hit of that is just, it needs to be greater. And often people do that because they can't keep up with the habit. So they up the ante. Mm.
There was huge news made, I think it's probably about 6 or 7 years ago now, Joanna, about cross-the-counter painkillers and people's attraction to them and their reliance on them. Is that still as big today, or has that died off?
Oh, no, I don't think for a minute it's died off. I think, again, in terms of range and variety, there's a lot of painkillers, and people are... Absolutely. And I think that's what you were talking about earlier on when we talk about prescribed opioids. The thing about opioids are, and it's the reason they'll continue to exist, is they are the best painkiller on the planet. And whether you're talking about a gaping fracture or a childhood trauma, it will numb the pain and people will continue to take them. But I think prescribed opioids are a problem, as you alluded to earlier, that's happening in the background. Particularly with an older population. I think we prescribe opioids in the high numbers, and I think it's a problem that, you know, we need to highlight a little bit more. But I think that's been an issue that's grown rather than increased rather than decreased.
Yeah. And is oxycodone regularly prescribed by GPs?
It's funny, this study that I'm about to kind of, that we're finalising now with HSC for the end of summer, it looks at oxycodone as one of the opioids that's prescribed, and it is continually described. It is obviously a controlled prescribed drug, but there's I'd say that people, yeah, there's a large number of people in receipt of that drug and other opioids that are similar in potency and should be. I think that's a public health message that we probably need to get out in front of as well.
Yeah, that in fact, oxycodone is, I think I was reading somewhere, it's twice as potent as morphine, whereas a lot of people believed down through the years that it was the opposite way around. Isn't that the case?
Well, they're all the same family of drug, you know, and I mean, this is one of my bugbears, is, you know, this notion that we stigmatize a heroin user over, you know, a morphine user. They're an identical, you know, drug. But yeah, they're all from the same family.
Yeah. Have you done much work, Joanna, in relation to the social addictions, as in, you know, the Xbox addiction, the internet addiction, the shopping addictions, retail addiction, retail therapy, as they call it.
It's not. My area has very much been on drugs, and and very much began with the opioids, but broader now in terms of addiction, but usually drug and alcohol, you know. So I haven't really done a whole lot there, but it is something that I would like to do more on.
Well, let me take you back then to something that may be more familiar, and that would be inhalants. Is that a huge problem?
Not so much, but I mean, what we're seeing now is nitrous oxide is something that is a gas that's inhaled that is widely used. And so people, I know a lot of people are really good at keeping on top of tidying up their local community. And often I get a lot of emails or I get a lot of contact from people who just come across canisters all of the time. And nitrous oxide, you know, again, it's something that's available because it has to be, because, you know, it has a function. It's used in hospitals, it's used in catering industry and stuff like that. But it's being heavily used. Again, across Europe, they were selling balloons in nightclubs, and now we're starting to see that being banned and changed and stuff like that. It is a control, you know, somewhat controlled here, but, I mean, people use them at house parties. So I would have said to you maybe 3-4 years ago, inhalants are kind of not something that people do. But now with the influx of nitrous oxide and people inhaling that, that's driving up a trend for sure. Again, in the nighttime economy, it's a big issue, and festivals and places like that.
Yeah. And what are your views on decriminalisation? Because I know that in January 2023, this was in an attempt to address the crisis in Canada. British Columbia became the first and only province in Canada to decriminalise the possession of a small amount of hard drugs. This was, they said, to reduce the barriers and stigma. And they're running on a pilot basis until 2026. They allow adults to possess up to 2.5 grams of heroin, fentanyl, cocaine or methamphetamine without being arrested, charged or having their drugs seized, except around schools and airports. How do you feel from your vast experience in this area? What are your views on that?
Well, for the reasons I mentioned earlier, I don't think criminalising people for a small amount of drugs does any good. I'm an advocate of decriminalisation for the purposes of, you know, not criminalising people so they don't have a criminal record that will curb their potential to recover and live a fuller, meaningful life. And I'm also a fan of diversion, you know, giving people an opportunity to, you know, get a health service or a treatment service over a criminal conviction. So I would be an advocate of that. For sure, yeah.
Mm. But where do you draw the line? And you would have to have very, very strict guidelines and strict parameters, wouldn't you?
Yeah, and often they do. Countries that decriminalise are very clear around the, you know, it will be for reasonable consumption. And I think we're quite, you know, we're quite clear about that, that you wouldn't have a kilo of something and claim that it's for personal use. So I think that's just another way to kind of stop negotiations by saying, like, there are things that can be very clearly worked out, you know, in terms of units and metrics. So that wouldn't be the fuss, you know.
Right. And do you think, and this was something I was thinking about today, has Ireland got a very old-fashioned view of these drugs? Would it help if decriminalisation came in to have a more cosmopolitan view of our attitudes towards these drugs? Are we old-fashioned?
I don't know that we're old-fashioned, but I equally don't know that we'd achieve what you've just talked about there. because it will still apply to people who are using drugs in a, you know, a particular setting. I think it would lift the stigma around drug use, and I think that we're very fixed in our ways of, you know, seeing people with addictions, which, you know, drives me nuts, but as, you know, somehow it's a moral failing or a flawed, you know, personality or whatever, instead of a health issue that people need support with.
Yeah.
So I think it would lift those, it would change some hearts and minds. I don't know if I've answered your question, but is it an old-fashioned view? It's an outdated view, so...
Yeah, sorry, that's a much better way of putting it, actually,
it's
Joanna.
It's not evidence-based.
Yeah. Yeah, outdated, yeah.
So we know, yeah.
Yeah, and in relation to medicinal cannabis, what are your views on that? Should that be more widely available? Because it is still extremely restricted, isn't it?
It is still extremely restricted, and I suppose to be quite fair and frank, I steer out of the medicinal space, so I don't know too much about it, other than it is available to people who need it, but I also see other advocates saying that there's people who are not getting access to it, but I wouldn't comment on it because I don't know too much about it.
Right, okay, yeah, and there seems to be that, it's almost like as if it's behind a protective barrier at the moment and nobody's prepared to discuss it. And when you try to draw politicians out on it, they tend to sort of say, oh, well, that's being examined and that's being viewed. Compared to where we were, and I'm kind of drawing into the last lap here. When you look back, say, 20 years ago to 2004, where are we now in relation to our view of drugs, to our use of drugs? Has it multiplied 1,000%? Is it getting out of control? Or does each generation go through that, almost like a rite of passage, where some people dabble and walk away if they're lucky enough. Mm-hmm. Some people become addicted if they're unlucky enough. In that sense, that you know, mentality, has it changed?
So are you asking me, has the views towards that changed, or has the actual presentation and growth of that changed?
The presentation and growth of that. In other words, the use of the drug. Is it as serious, or is it even more serious? I know there's a greater availability and there's a greater choice of drugs and a greater mixture of drugs. But is the population more drawn to using drugs?
I think that, like I said, that there's always going to be a population that, you know, use drugs and transition in and transition out. And it's just, as you say, a rite of passage and part of society and all the rest. But I do think that there's a perpetuating context in which people use drugs and become addicted, and that they're more social, psychosocial, mm-hmm. and that we're kind of going around in a space, and unless we address those issues, we'll always be where we've always been, you know?
Mm-hmm. Listen, it's been wonderful talking to you, Joanna, and thank you so much for staying up so late to have the conversation with us. But I think there are a lot of listeners who are grateful for you to have chatted to us tonight. And take care,
thanks,
and we'll talk to you soon. Keep up the good work. Thank you.
Take care. Bye.
Thank you very much. That's Professor Joanna Ivers from Trinity College in Dublin. That's it. All the time we've got for you for tonight and indeed this week on Nighttime Talk. Producer was Jane McNamara. Thanks also to Anya, and thanks to you for tuning in. Back with you next week, and back with you on Saturday morning just after 10 o'clock. From me, Gareth O'Callaghan, have a safe and a peaceful night. Good night.
Nighttime Talk. Call us now on 0818 942 105.
Ireland's Classic Hits Radio.
Jobs Expo Cork is back. The leading careers fair in the South returns to UCC's De Vere Hall on Saturday 25th of May, packed with job vacancies and opportunities. Join us on the day and meet some of Munster's leading employers, attend exciting talks and get CV and career advice all free of charge. That's Jobs Expo Cork, Saturday 25th of May at UCC's De Vere Hall. Register for your free tickets at jobsexpo.ie. We'll be right back.
Before you buy new tiles or choose bathware for your new home, take a look at what the Tile Factory Ennis Diamond offer. Because as well as a great choice of bathroom, kitchen, wall and floor tiles and a wide range of bathware, we can arrange the best deals from the leading manufacturers and guarantee to beat any quote you bring us. See our price guarantee in store today.